You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon.
That was Gerald Ford in 1976 announcing the presidential pardon of Richard Nixon for crimes related to Watergate. According to former constitutional rights attorney Glenn Greenwald, that moment set an important precedent that has allowed many of the politically powerful and wealthy to break laws without fear of any serious repercussions. His latest book is called With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. It's published by Metropolitan Books. I'm very pleased to welcome Glenn Greenwald to our program today.
Great. Hello. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
And you write, quote, the central promise of the American founding that all would stand equal before the law, the rule of law, no matter what, has been abandoned. Now, hasn't that been true pretty much since the founding?
Well, this is, though, the critical point, which is, of course, it's true that the founders, as they lavish praise on this principle of equality before the law, violated in all sorts of violent and fundamental ways. And that's true for the next two centuries as well. The difference is that even when that principle was being violated, we were affirming it very enthusiastically, vocally, even unanimously. And it wasn't until really the Ford pardon of Nixon, which is why I identify that as such a critical development in this regard, where Gerald Ford went on television and basically expressly repudiated the idea of the rule of law. He said, of course, I believe that the rule of law is no respecter of persons. That's the crux of the rule of law. But he then added this concocted amendment designed to gut the principle that he had just invoked. He said, but the law is a respecter of reality, meaning if it's too disruptive or too divisive to hold politically powerful people accountable, we should suspend the rule of law. And that's become normalized.
And what would have happened if Richard Nixon had been tried? That really would have shaken up the whole American political system, wouldn't it, despite the fact that he had been a law and order president?
Well, that's one of the more remarkable things, is that he rejuvenated his career based on this law and order banner that we should punish harshly all crimes and not take into consideration root causes or the effects on communities. Apparently, that only applied to ordinary Americans. Sure, there would have been a lot of political distraction and a political divisiveness from putting Richard Nixon on trial, but I think this rhetorical template that got created, that if you're sufficiently powerful and instrumental, and it's seeped in now to the private sector as well, has been far more damaging.
But there are all sorts of other reasons that people are not sent to jail. Oliver North wasn't sent to jail, even though it was clear that he had broken all sorts of laws. Because we also have a complicated political system.
Sure. And if you go through the process, as Oliver North did, and you're given due process and you're charged with crimes and convicted and you have your conviction overturned on appeal, then I think that's not really quite the same thing. What we're really talking about here is the preordained decision that political and media elites should not be, or financially should not be, held accountable at all under the rule of law.
Many members of what might be called today's Washington elite served in the Nixon White House. Do you think that they took the wrong lessons from what happened after Watergate?
I think they took the right lessons. I mean, the person who eulogized Gerald Ford and heaped lavish praise on the pardon was Dick Cheney, who in 2006 himself was accused of all sorts of criminal activity. And so there's this sort of ongoing elite interest in having this rhetorical template sustain that if political and media and financial elites get caught breaking the law, it's in everyone's interest to shield them from accountability.
Although Dick Cheney was unable to convince President Bush to give a full pardon to Scooter Libby, he did President Bush did commute his sentence.
Right. He commuted his sentence, so we never spent a second in jail, even though there are tens of thousands of people less powerful in jail for obstruction of justice and perjury. But I think the Libby case is interesting. I mean, one of the only times that elites and the powerful in our society are held accountable under the law is when the victims, the grievants, are other elites. And the reason Louis Libby was prosecuted was because it was the CIA demanding that investigation because he had added one of their agents. Had that not happened, it's almost inconceivable that he would have been brought before a court.
But it did send a message, didn't it?
I mean, the ultimate message was that, again, that political elites and if you're politically powerful enough, you don't get treated on equal terms with ordinary Americans. And yes, he got convicted, but he never went to prison, even though the unanimous jury sentenced him to 33 months. And this is what we see over and over. For an isolated case, you can make an argument for each individual case that maybe leniency is warranted. But the other problem is that we've never seen this leniency or almost never see it when it comes to ordinary Americans. We imprison them more harshly and more frequently than in any other country on the earth. And that's the two-tier justice system.
Well, let's talk about one of the things that you focus on, wiretapping. If I were to arrange to have you wiretapped without your knowledge and without a warrant, what kind of criminal penalties would I face?
Any individual who eavesdrops on the communications of another American without the warrants required by the FISA law, which is going to the FISA court and getting permission, is subject to a 5-year prison term and a $10,000 fine for each offense. And of course, the New York Times revealed that the Bush administration had been spying on Americans without warrants in thousands of cases on American soil. Pure criminal activity.
And nobody's ever been indicted.
Nobody's ever been indicted. The only person who paid any price was this individual named Thomas Tam, who was the mid-level Justice Department lawyer who found out that this law was being broken, picked up the phone and called Eric Lichtblau at the New York Times. He lost his job over it. He had no money to hire a lawyer. He went bankrupt and had all kinds of problems. Only the one who exposed the crimes suffered. The criminals themselves suffered none.
Is that often the case? The whistleblower is the one who winds up paying the biggest price?
Sure. And then if you look at what the Obama administration is doing now with how it is arguing that Bush torture regime should not be held accountable under the law, that the warrantless eavesdropping program shouldn't be, that even the private sector crimes that precipitated the 2008 financial crisis shouldn't be, the argument they make is it's more important to look forward and not backwards. But again, if that were applied across the board, even to the marginalized, then you could have a debate about it, but it wouldn't offend rule of law principles. But the Obama administration is on a unprecedented war against whistleblowers to punish people who expose government criminality, but not to punish the criminals themselves.
That's why Bradley Manning is under such deep threat for sending things to WikiLeaks?
I believe so. I mean, you know, when the detention conditions of Bradley Manning were first known, the question was, why would the Obama administration do that? It seems counterproductive. They're creating sympathy for Manning. They're jeopardizing their ability to use his statements against him in prosecution because of the claim that it was coerced. And I think what's clear is they're sending a signal to say, if you also learn of things that we've done in secret that are high-level law-breaking, you should think twice about whether you'll expose it, because look what we've done to Bradley Manning.
But whistleblowers have all sorts of protections under the law. How come they don't always apply? I don't mean Bradley Manning. He may very well have criminally leaked things. But the whistleblower who revealed warrantless wiretaps, I would think that he would have been protected.
But he wasn't, and that was Thomas Tam, who was criminally investigated. And the reason is that they have protections if they invoke a internal procedure within the government. So they go to their boss or they go to an investigative agency within that department and expose it. But that goes nowhere. Those are always whitewashes. So leaking to the media, which is the traditional way that we learn about important aspects of criminality, that does not have any whistleblower protection.
But shouldn't the government be able to keep some secrets?
Some secrets, yes. And the problem is that we have gone from keeping some secrets to having a government in which virtually everything of any significance is kept behind a wall of secrecy, including huge amounts of things that are simply embarrassing or corrupt or illegal, and that's an abuse of the secrecy power.
Don't former administration officials argue that the wiretapping program was necessary to keep the country safe in the wake of 9/11 and that it was done in the best interests of the nation?
Well, two things. I mean, the argument itself never made sense because they had extraordinary powers to eavesdrop on terrorists. They just had to get warrants from the FISA court first to do it. But we don't have a country where government leaders can break the law, laws that the American people passed through their Congress, and then afterwards say, well, you should overlook it because we had a good reason for doing so. We're a nation of laws, not men, and that's exactly what that prohibits.
My guess is Glenn Greenwald, his book With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Do you think that the public outcry about the warrantless wiretapping program was match in any way what we saw after the Nixon administration's wiretapping was revealed?
Well,
It was
a lot more extensive, although at the time, the Nixon eavesdropping wasn't really illegal. And that's what led to the enactment of FISA in 1977, where we said, we don't trust our government to eavesdrop now without judicial warrants. If they do it, it's a felony. So that's one main difference, is it was legal versus illegal. But even, you know, in the Nixonian age, one of the things they were obsessed with was destroying whistleblowers as well. They tried to get the files of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist to destroy him personally, to undermine the credibility of the Pentagon Papers leak. This is what has been going on forever, is the U.S. government trying to really intimidate those who would expose their secrets.
In 2007, Congress voted to give major telecoms companies like AT&T retroactive immunity from lawsuits that were seeking to uncover facts about the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping program. Is the idea of retroactive immunity unusual in the legal world?
It's extraordinary. The only other example you can find where retroactive immunity was sought was by a series of five or six big banks in the 1960s who merged with one another, knowing that it violated the antitrust law. And their argument was, well, we'll just do it and they'll never be able to undo it, because by then it'll be too difficult to undo.
And what happened?
And they started prosecuting them for antitrust violations, and they demanded immunity, retroactive immunity. And Robert Kennedy and Nicholas Kassenbach, the then attorney general, exploded and went to Capitol Hill and gave the most stirring addresses, saying this is one of the most obscene threats to the rule of law you can imagine. Nothing like that happened when it came time to talk about retroactive amnesty for the telecoms, whose lawbreaking was at least as deliberate.
Do you see a direct line between the thinking that led to the Nixon pardon and the thinking that eventually gave the telecoms immunity?
I think one of the things that's happened is, if you look at what Ford said, that mindset we have to move beyond as a nation. It's if you're sufficiently important, you don't want to put them through the rigors of prosecution. That became normalized, and it happened in the Iran-Contra defendants, and then it seeped into the private sector, to telecoms and now Wall Street tycoons.
Now, why do you think that so many Democrats, including then-Senator Obama, voted for the bill?
Well, interestingly, Obama, when he was seeking the nomination, actually vowed and promised unequivocally that he would vote against any bill that had telecom immunity and even filibuster it. He changed his mind because he had the nomination by then and didn't want to have the issue harm his political prospects. But I think the real reason is the telecoms hired a huge army of bipartisan lobbyists, ex-officials from both parties who had great access to the halls of Congress and were able to go in and persuade the members of Congress that their lobby counted, and there was no countervailing lobby that had an influence.
My guest is Glenn Greenwald, the author of the New York Times bestsellers How Would a Patriot Act and A Tragic Legacy. He has recently been proclaimed one of the 25 most influential political commentators by The Atlantic magazine. His latest book is called With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. It's published by Metropolitan Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Glenn Greenwald. His latest book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. It's published by Metropolitan Books. Glenn, one of the main complaints I've heard from Occupy Wall Street protesters is that nearly no one responsible for the 2008 financial crisis has been prosecuted or gone to jail. Do you see that as part of the same thing that you're writing about?
Absolutely. I devoted a whole chapter to that. That's what's one of the most amazing things. It's not just that there were crimes committed by the most powerful political and financial elites. It's that it's the most egregious and destructive crimes. You have the worldwide torture regime, spying on American citizens without warrants, an aggressive attack on Iraq. And here's systemic fraud that precipitated a major financial crisis that has destroyed the economic security of tens of millions of people. Even Alan Greenspan said there was substantial fraud that led to it, and yet no criminal investigations, let alone criminal accountability or prosecutions of any kind.
So what do you think of Occupy Wall Street? Do you think, as some have claimed, that the protesters need more concrete demands in order to effect real change?
I don't. I think one of the geniuses of Occupy Wall Street is that it's really a way of saying, from on behalf of many citizens, that we dissent from the political and legal institutions because we think they are inherently corrupt. And to start, you know, offering legislative solutions that would go right into that system is sort of undermining that premise, I think what they're doing is they're saying we want to change the political culture through a gathering of citizens.
Well, some of them do carry signs saying reenact Glass-Steagall, but there's no real push for something like that.
Yeah, it's not uniform. It's very isolated. There's no overriding legislative message.
Last month, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner went on CNBC and was asked about complaints that no one on Wall Street has been investigated or prosecuted, and here's what he had to say.
One of the things that the Occupy Wall Street people point out is that there's been no criminal charges or anything related to what's happened in the financial crisis.
That's not true. And you've seen very, very dramatic enforcement actions already by the enforcement authorities across the U.S. government, and I'm sure you're going to see more to come. You should stay tuned for that.
What do you think about that? Do you think we'll see more to come?
Well, he says he there's going to be more to come. But if what he means is it's going to be more of what we've seen, then it's not very exciting. We've seen a handful of civil actions against the biggest banks that resulted in woefully inadequate settlements, basically the cost of doing business. Nothing criminal, even though this was widespread crime. So it was really just a way of a pretense of accountability that the investment banks didn't even blink at.
Now, often in those settlements, they don't have to admit any wrongdoing. Does that really matter? I mean, everybody assumes that was just part of the deal.
I think the much bigger part of the deal is how much money they end up paying and the compensation that they offer to the people whom they've harmed. And those amounts have been a tiny fraction of the overall transactions and the money that they've made, so that it would never be a deterrent again, because it's way too small of a fraction of what they earned.
Well, Countrywide CEO Angelo Mozilla was prosecuted, wasn't he? And then we have hedge fund billionaire Rajaratnam sentenced for 11 years in jail for conspiracy and securities fraud.
Right. And so, for example, Mozilla, and you know, none of these are absolute propositions. I mean, of course, you can find an elite here and there being held accountable under the law. You can find an ordinary American who gets leniency now and then, too. These are overall trends. But even there, Mozilla ended up paying a $70 million fine, which sounds like a lot until you consider that his earnings, his profit over the last 7 years for massive fraud was in excess of $500 million, which he's now going to retire with. This is how it always happens, is they make it seem as though there's some meaningful accountability, but in the scheme of Wall Street, it's actually negligible.
That's less than people are asking for the millionaire's tax.
Exactly.
But sometimes people do go to jail. Jack Abramoff just got out of jail.
Mm-hmm. And the Enron executives went to jail, and they were well connected. You know, I talk about that in the book. I mean, if you can look at the exceptions, basically it falls into one of two categories. You can find elites who end up being prosecuted because other elites are the grievance, like Louis Libby angering the CIA, or where they're just so brazen and so overt in their criminality that some accountability is necessary to prevent the game from being given up, like a Rod Blagojevich.
You write that Goldman Sachs' dominance of political and legal institutions is deep-rooted and then thus offers a superb demonstration of how elites shield themselves from repercussions of lawbreaking. How do they do that?
One of the extraordinary things is how much Goldman Sachs supported the Obama 2008 campaign with money. It then had numerous officials, former officials, current officials, filling the top positions in the Treasury Department, in the White House, in all kinds of important economic advisory roles. So they constantly are moving in and out of government. And so the government that's supposed to be regulating them is actually filled with Goldman Sachs and its acolytes.
Last night, Jack Abramoff was on 60 Minutes, and he said that one of the things he would say to somebody he was trying to influence was, after you leave Washington, I want you to join my firm. And he said, I owned him from that moment on. He also suggested that a law be passed that disallows anybody who served in government from being able to lobby.
I mean, this in and out is something that even in mainstream sources now is being described as an oligarchy. There's an article in the June 2010 issue of The Atlantic by Simon Johnson, the former chief economist at the IMF. And he has entitled his article, The Quiet Coup. And he describes that we now have an oligarchical coup that has taken over our democratic institutions. And that's the kind of thing he's talking about.
There were people who were accused of crimes earlier who wound up serving in Washington. Elliot Abrams, John Poindexter, John Negroponte, all connected to the Iran-Contra scandal, and winding up with prominent positions in the Bush White House. So even if you're charged with a crime, you still can have a political afterlife in Washington?
Apparently. And I think that's because the political media class really do not believe, and they say this expressly, that crimes committed in office with the power that you have are actual real crimes, the way drug dealers on the street are criminals. These are policy differences. These are bad mistakes, even though they do exactly that which the law prohibits.
And you point to the treatment of former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger as one of the best examples of elite immunity.
I mean, here was somebody who got caught red-handed lying to federal investigators and to the Congress. He had a diary that showed what Ronald Reagan's involvement was. He hid it until the end. When it was found, it proved that almost everything that he had said was a lie. He was about to go on trial. George H.W. Bush, a month away from leaving office, pardoned him and four others, ending the investigation. And almost every media figure in Washington was supportive because Caspar Weinberger was one of them. He doesn't go to prison. Only drug dealers on the corner do.
My guest is Glenn Greenwald. His book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality, Protect the Powerful, published by Metropolitan Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned the media. What is the role of the press? How you said that the Washington Press Corps thought that it was a good idea to pardon Caspar Weinberger, and did they go along with pretty much all of the pardons that we've seen so far?
Absolutely. The citizenry was against the Ford pardon of Nixon, but the media class was out there defending it. They were almost unanimous against investigating the crimes of the Bush era, even though polls show that Americans supported that. And I think what you've really seen is that there's been a fundamental change in the media class. 50 years ago, they were outsiders. They were basically poor. They were insurgents. Now they're employees of large media corporations. They make multi-million dollars a year. They identify far more with the political class than they do as outsiders to it, and that's why they vigorously defend its interests.
And you point out that Time Magazine's Joe Klein was against Scooter Libby spending any time in jail for outing Valerie Plame Wilson, but he argued for Paris Hilton spending jail time for a traffic infraction.
Right, on the grounds that it was needed to show that the rule of law still applies. This is the extent to which D.C. media figures go to protect and shield high-level political officials from the rule of law. It's really, they've taken on the leading role.
But there's another side here. We see the one administration pardoning the people from a previous administration. Is that because they also understand that somewhere down the line they're going to need a similar favor?
Well, there's a fascinating article from December 2008 in the New York Times, right after Obama had gotten elected, in which it said that he is now unmistakably signaling that he's opposed to investigations into Bush torture and eavesdropping schemes. And what the New York Times said was that there's basically a gentleman's agreement where each president has in his interest the protection of the crimes of the prior administration so that he knows that he too can commit crimes in office with impunity.
We did see some people doing jail time from the savings and loan scandal. Why was it so different with this much more serious economic crisis that's led to this great recession?
Well, I think time was much different in the sense that although wealthy and deep pockets exercise control over the political process, nowhere near to the extent that they do now, so that every politician is petrified of alienating the highest financial echelon of power in the United States. And that's particularly true of Wall Street. You know, Savings and Loan Bank was sort of a sliver of that industry. You're talking here in 2008 about Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Lehman Brothers, really the crux of American finance that funds both parties.
And you say of Secretary Geithner's handling of the crisis that to the extent Geithner took action at all, it was to shield those financial firms from any meaningful government oversight.
He was both at the New York Fed and then once he became Treasury Secretary, absolutely devoted to that.
I read that President Obama wanted to break up the Citigroup and he resisted it, just ignored the president's request.
Well, Geithner was known for being extremely close to the New York banks when he was at the New York Fed. He was an acolyte of Robert Rubin and Larry Summers, the people who sort of caused the problem, and those are the people who Obama chose to empower to clean up the very problem they had created, and so it's not really surprising what they did.
Well, what about Congress's role? Congress had a financial inquiry commission.
Into the financial crisis?
Yeah.
Yeah, they issued a report, and the report sort of identified some wrongdoers, but it was very tepid about whether crimes had been committed. It wasn't a bad report, but it was just very dispassionate, and it was obvious that it would produce nothing of any meaningful accountability, and that's what it produced.
Well, I guess part of the problem is also that we're not always sure what's illegal. We may think something was wrong-headed, but not illegal. John Yoo is now teaching, I think, at Berkeley. Some people felt that his torture memos went over the line.
And Condoleezza Rice is teaching at Stanford, despite choreographing torture from the White House and leading the way.
Well, she denies that in her book.
But the ABC News is pretty clear about that she presided over those meetings. But
people fail upward.
We don't consider elite crimes to be actual crimes, and therefore no one has it held against them.
So how do we compare with other countries?
Well, I mean, if you can look at actually other countries where leading members of the political class are being held accountable. In Iceland, for example, they had a financial crisis as bad as ours, and they concluded that their political leaders knew about the crisis that was coming but purposely didn't take action against it because their allies and supporters were people who were benefiting from it, and there's recommendations that they be prosecuted, and the former prime minister is being held accountable in the legal system for that. It's inconceivable that that would happen in the United States.
Although it hasn't happened in Greece, where George Papandreou is paying the price for trying to clean up the mess that his predecessors left him. Maybe he didn't do a good enough job.
Yeah, I think that...
And maybe Obama isn't doing a good enough job here, as many Americans feel.
Yeah, I think that the crimes of political leaders are more along the war crimes that we've been talking about. The financial crimes are really private sector crimes that the government simply was negligent in overseeing and failing to stop.
Actually, isn't the mood in Congress to move away from even the kind of level of regulation we have now?
They're... Actually, the ethos in Congress is Watergate, is Wall Street has been regulated too little. That was the orgy of deregulation we saw in the 1990s, and people are willing to do so even more. But what's amazing, again, is for ordinary Americans, we have the biggest penal system, one of the harshest in the world, and that never changes. This leniency is found only among the powerful.
We have one of the highest rates of incarceration in the Western world.
We have the highest rate of incarceration on the planet. We imprison more of our citizens than any other country in the world, including China and India, with many more times the people. The most amazing statistic is the United States accounts for 5% of the world's population, and yet 25% of the prison population worldwide is inside the United States.
Most of them on drug charges.
Most on drug charges or other petty transgressions that no other Western country would imprison people for.
And recently, legal services for poor Americans have been defunded, haven't they?
Amazingly, as bad as they were, you're to the point now where if you are charged with a felony in the United States that can send you to prison for 2 decades and you are indigent, your public defender will have an average of 7 minutes in many counties to be able to speak with you about for the entire duration of the case.
When President Obama came into office, didn't he have an opportunity to turn things around? Why do you think he didn't?
He repeatedly promised during the campaign that he would commission a genuine inquiry into whether these things that were done were crimes and warranted prosecution.
And people voted for him because they felt he was going to do that.
Based on that, absolutely. And I think part of it became that he thought that the political risk wasn't worth it. And part of it was that he began continuing many of those same policies, and it would have been a lot of Democrats were implicated in them as well. So it would have been very difficult for him to do so.
And right now, that hasn't helped him at all. Republicans hate him as much as they would have if he had gone after
them. That was the argument, was we would have divisiveness if he did it. Can you imagine what things would have looked like? Not much different.
Now, haven't things like WikiLeaks enabled citizens to know more about wrongdoing? It looks now like WikiLeaks might finally be destroyed.
Well, those two thoughts go together perfectly, right? I mean, when somebody steps up and actually exposes what the government is doing, they immediately become an enemy of the state. And there was a report from the Pentagon in 2008 declaring WikiLeaks an enemy of the state and plotting to destroy it, and they've obviously succeeded.
Glenn Greenwald is a former constitutional law and civil rights attorney. He's a contributing writer at Salon. And his latest book is called With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. It is published by Metropolitan Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.